try to focus on the great wealth that the Klai Yisrael left Mitzrayim with. They later got the Yam Suf, even greater wealth. And to me, at least, it's one of those things which you learn about when you're in kindergarten or first grade or second grade, and as many other things in Yiddishkeit, especially if you are what they call FFB and you went through the yeshiva system, it kind of just stays that way your whole life. And it's only one day will ask you, well, why is the money so important? You're like, gee, I never thought about that. Good morning. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, I figured if you go upstairs, you'll find your way down here. Sorry about that. So, it's one of those things which you learn about. There's a big deal made about the Rechush Gadol, the great wealth that the Jewish people would leave with, eventually left Egypt with, and you say, okay, that's nice, and it kind of stays that way. And you don't necessarily think about it that much until someone says, why is that important? I mean, why is there such a focus on the money? Why is there such a focus on the wealth? And as I'll try to illustrate, it's a big deal. It's clearly a big deal. And really the first question you have to ask is, why is it such a big deal? Why is there such a focus on the wealth? Seemingly, Pesach, we're not celebrating wealth. Yes, we do put all our silver and everything on the table, and we're supposed to display as a means of cheiris, of freedom. But it's not necessarily a holiday that focuses on wealth, except for perhaps the transfer from our pockets to the matzah bakers. But outside of that, from the Easter question, he's got to make a living, but the matzah bakery is just, you know, it increases exponentially from year to year, unless you're buying it through the shul, in which case it's half price. But it's, you know, someone told me it's going $30 a pound this year, matzah. Not just here in Denver, but even like, I think in Lakewood, it's going like $26 a pound, something like that. So, that's why I've always said, lechem oinim, because it leaves you poor. That's right. So clearly, So clearly, there seems to be a very great deal of importance attached to the wealth. And why? Before I continue, I just want to take the opportunity to thank Mr. Polson for making arrangements and for contacting people and for making this class happen. So thank you very much. And as I mentioned before I started the class, we're focusing on money here. I hope everyone gets their money's worth out of this class. So what's the big
deal?
Well, it is about Pesach. So, we were just talking about the expense of making Yom Tov. So I want to share with you a passage in the Gemara in Brachos that you've probably heard before, a lot of you, if not all of you. And the Gemara says as follows. Hashem tells Moshe, Dabar na ba'ozni ha'om. Please speak into the ears of the people. Okay? And the Gemara says, and here Hashem tells Moshe to tell B'nai Yisrael to borrow from their Egyptian neighbors and so on, all their clay kesef, their clay zav, the gold and the silver, and so on. Why is it saying no, please? So the Gemara says, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard this before, Eino el loshen bakasha, no is a request. Please do this for me. Because Hashem said to Moshe, I'm asking you, please go tell Israel, please ask your neighbors. I'm begging you, ask your neighbors for their gold and their silver. Why? Because Shloyimar Oisei Tzadik, that Tzadik Avraham Avinu should not say Va'avodim Ve'inu Oisim Kaim Bohem. Hashem fulfilled in Bnei Yisrael the promise of the Bris Ben Absarim that they will enslave them and afflict them. But the Acher Ken Yetsu B'Chush Gadol, the promise that afterwards they will leave with great wealth, Lo'ikim Bohem, that he did not fulfill. Okay. So the question jumps out at you right away. I'm sure you've all had this question at some point. Hashem made a promise, right? So if Avram wouldn't say anything, so then Hashem's off the hook. Okay, I made a promise, but no one will notice. He's not a politician running for president over here, right? I mean, he'll just make promises and then just, you know, shove them under the rug. Hashem makes a promise, he keeps it. But it sounds like Hashem only has to keep his promise because if not, Avram Avinu is going to complain. Hashem has to keep his promise whether Avram Avinu complains or not. Question number one. Question number two is, ostensibly, Hashem has a good reason to explain why he would perhaps not keep his promise. Assuming he has a good reason, just tell Avram, listen, Avram, maybe there was a misunderstanding, but here's the real story. So I know I made the promise, but you know it was on these terms, and now here are these terms instead. So I'm sorry that there was a misunderstanding, but you know, Avram Avinu is not going to say, well, one second, let's go back to that contract and look at it. You know, if Hashem tells Avram Avinu, this is how it is, he managed the Akedah, he'll manage the wealth. So, although, as an aside, Rashi does say that after the whole Akedah was finished, Avram said, okay, Hashem, let's talk. Let's understand what just happened over here. And the Mefarshim point out that after the whole test was over, at that point Avram had a right to ask Hashem what happened. Okay, that's as an aside.
Where is,
so, what?
Where is that conversation?
There's that conversation. Rashi says it at the end of the Parshas Vayera. I could show you the Rashi later if you'd like. There's actually a whole piece from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik where he boils it down to the idea when you have two different ideas in the Torah that contradict each other. So you have a stira, you have a contradiction. And then you can't resolve it until the third pasuk comes in and resolves it. If you come to shul on time on Shabbos morning, you'll hear them say that. That's one of the 13 midas that they say before Kaddish, before they start davening. So he has a whole discussion over there that Avram was able to ask the question after Hashem told him to take him down from his Mizbeach. So there's one there was just, I'm starting going off on a tangent, it's just interesting. One thing was, Yitzchak will be your future. Pasuk number two that contradicted was, put Yitzchak on the Mizbeach. And then pasuk number three was taken down. So that's pasuk number three. So Avram said, now I have three psukim. The third pasuk Hashem will resolve the first two. Please tell me how to resolve them. That's as an aside. Okay, but that's the question. Why, Hashem has a good reason. Let him explain it to Avram. Okay? And again, the overarching question of this whole thing is, what's up with the money? Why is there such a big deal about it? Hashem promises Avram, part of the plan of Mitzrayim is Egypt, slavery, suffering, exodus, money. That's part of it. Why? Why is that so important? Okay, it's alluded to in Parshas Vayechi, when Parshas Vayigash, when Bnei Yisrael settled in Goshen, Rashi points out in one of the psukim over there, I forget which one, that it's an allusion to the fact that Bnei Yisrael would suck out all the wealth when they left Mitzrayim. The pasuk in Parshas Bo'i, when they left Mitzrayim, Vayinatzlus Mitzrayim, they emptied out Mitzrayim. Rashi says they emptied out like the depths of the sea that have no fish in it. So it's over and over again. It's such a big deal. Why? Why is it such a big deal? So there are a few hakdomas, a few prefaces we have to understand the answer and to really build this out and to understand how it plays into the whole story of Yitzias Mitzrayim. Let's go back. Those who are familiar with my shiurim know that I often go back to Adam Arishan, but we're not going to go back to Adam Arishan yet. We're going to go back to Yaakov by Lavan. Yaakov and Lavan. Yaakov goes to Lavan's house. Okay, marries Leah, marries Rachel, works for him for 14 years. After the 14 years are up, Yosef is born, and Yaakov, as Rashi points out, Yaakov says, okay, Yosef is born. Yosef is the one who can overcome Esav. Now I can face Esav. Time for me to go. And he goes to Lavan and says, okay, I finished my terms of servitude, 14 years for your two daughters, Zagizun, I'm going back to Eretz Yisrael. Lavan says, no, hold on a second. You brought me good fortune. I'd like you to hang around. Let's make a deal. You'll stay here longer. You'll work for me. What are your terms? And then we have the famous, all the different terms. Lavan tries to trick Yaakov, etc., etc. It's very strange. Yaakov decided it's time to go. Lavan says, why don't you hang around a little longer? Now, most of the people here are on the receiving end, on the giving end, and what I'm about to say. But when the kids come for Pesach, so they stay for Pesach, you have two results afterwards. Either it's, okay, Pesach's over, bye-bye, see you next Pesach. Or, depending on how Yom Tov went, or it's, why don't you stay another day, a couple more days, then you could go, you know. So, almost, you know, that seems to be like what's happened with Lavan. Lavan, you know, Lavan tries desperately to be the Zaydi of Klal Yisrael. That, by the way, is the whole conflict Yaakov and Lavan is Lavan wants to be the Zaydi of Klal Yisrael. And Yaakov is going to, at all costs, make sure he's not. And that, by the way, is a deeper understanding, once in that Pesach, of Arami Oyvirovi. Lavan tried desperately to put his tumah, his impurity, his worldview into Klal Yisrael as hard as he could. At the end, Lavan says, everything you have is mine. Yaakov says, not one cent is yours. I got everything fair and square. You have no say in Klal Yisrael whatsoever. Okay? But Lavan says to Yaakov, why don't you hang around a little bit? And you'll work for me. And Yaakov says, okay, good idea. I got to provide for my family. I'll stay. He stays for another 6 years. Since when is Lavan the one calling the shots for when Yaakov has to go back to Eretz Yisrael? Rivka told Yaakov, go to my brother, stay there for a few years, until Esav calms down. Yitzchak says, once she's at it, she tells him also, marry over there. He got married, he fulfilled his mother's wishes, time to go back. Why is he staying another 6 years for? Okay? Even more strange is that six years later, after Yaakov has amassed all this wealth, The Torah tells us that Yaakov looks at Lavan, and Lavan is not smiling at him the way he used to. His ponim, his face, is not so happy with him anymore. Poshup shot, the simple understanding, because Yaakov has amassed a great deal of wealth at Lavan's expense, so Lavan has had quite enough of this. But it took six years for Lavan to come to that point. And then when Yaakov sees that Lavan's not so happy, he says to himself, okay, Lavan doesn't like me anymore, now it's time to leave. So again, it seems like Lavan's calling the shots. As long as I'm getting on with my father-in-law, I'll stay in town. But if my father doesn't want me anymore, now it's time to leave. Again, is that how Yaakov determines for us, maybe, you know, us today, maybe that's a practical way to deal with in-laws and so on. But for Yaakov Avinu, who's not living his life based on that, he's living his life based on what Hashem wants, so he should have gone back ostensibly 6 years ago. Oh, Lavan doesn't like me anymore, time to go. And in fact, Hashem that very night comes to him and says, Yaakov, time to go. Then he goes and he tells Rachel and Leah, it's time to go, and they leave. What is going on with Yaakov and Lavan? So the Mefarshim explain, Rav Gedalia Shor talks about this, Shemesh Shmuel talks about this, and they make the following point. And they say, this is more of a Kabbalistic idea, and the idea is as follows. Everything that Hashem gives us, there's a purpose for us to do with it, right? That we know. We have wealth, we have money, we have talents, etc., etc. There's a purpose of something for us to do with it. Okay, in more Kabbalistic terms, I'll just use the more Kabbalistic terms, they're called Nitzaitzis of Kedusha, sparks of holiness. Okay, and now I'll go back to Adam Arishain, and I will say that when Adam Arishain ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, okay, the Mefarshim say that what happened was, it's called the tree of knowledge of good and evil, meaning everything got mixed together. Good and evil are now mixed. That's why everything bad tastes good. And everything that you shouldn't do has some element that pulls you and so on, okay, because there is some good in it. It's very difficult for us to really discern whether sometimes intellectually, certainly emotionally and practically, what's really good for us and what's not. Okay? And so we need, so after Adam Arishan's chait, our job as Klal Yisrael ultimately is to separate the good from the bad. Separate the good from the bad. So every time you eat and you make a bracha and you eat for the right reasons, you are separating the good from the bad. I'm not eating because I'm a horse. I'm an animal that just enjoys eating. I'm eating because Hashem made this. I recognize it came from Hashem. I'm going to sanctify it. You are separating the good from the bad. The Mishnah tells us, one who eats, three people who ate and they spoke words of Torah, it's like they broke karbonis. It's like they ate from the meat of karbonis. If they ate and they did not speak words of Torah, it's like they ate from sacrifices of Avodah Zarah. Why? Because eating is a very physical engagement. It gives us the opportunity to take the sanctity, those sparks, to separate the good from the bad. How you apply yourself to any activity will determine whether you're engaged in a holy activity or in a very mundane or worse activity. Okay? So if you eat properly, you're speaking words of Torah, meaning you're applying yourself to the eating in the proper fashion, then, good morning, then you are eating from karbonis. You're taking an animal, a piece, a steak, a hunk of meat, a physical thing, you're giving it to Hashem. That's your eating. If you're just eating because you're hungry, because you enjoy the food, whatever, it's like eating from sacrifices of Avodah Zarah. In other words, you are connecting to the negative side, which is always the idea of Avodah Zarah, the negative side of thing, not to the positive side. Okay, that is, and that, said in the Mefarshim, was what Yaakov needed to do. Yaakov goes into Golos, Yaakov goes to Lavan, Yaakov goes to Haran. And he has to pull out from there all the sanctity from Haran. You know what he does? He pulls out a Leah, he pulls out a Rachel, pulls out a Bilhah and a Zilpah also. That's a separate discussion I don't have time for now, I'm sorry. Very interesting discussion about Bilhah and Zilpah as well. Where do they fit into the whole picture? Are they? Aren't they? You know, they're not Emoites, but they have four of the tribes some other time. But I have to make sure that you all come back next time. And so that's Bilhah and Zilpah. And so here's the deal. Lavan has within him Kedusha as well. Lavan has within him elements of Kedusha. He's not living, he's not connecting to it, he's not utilizing it, but it's there. And Yaakov's mission is to go to Haran and pull all that Kedusha out. Okay? Keep in mind, the reason why the Avos were so into marrying into their family was because the potential for Kedusha in their family was very great. There's a lot of Kedusha locked up over there. Okay, Avram came out from that family. Yitzchak, Yaakov came out from that family. There's a lot of Kedusha locked up over there. They have to pull it out. So Lavan obviously is a dismal failure, but Yaakov can make it work. So Yaakov's going to go there, and Yaakov has to pull all the Kedusha out of Lavan. Marries Rachel, marries Leah, he says, okay, I'm done. Lavan gives him a big smile and says, can you stay a little bit? So Yaakov says, and the Shem Yishmol points out, bad people and good people don't usually get along with each other. Okay, and in Ruchnius, that's the case. Rishon can't stand Tzadikim. Rabbi Yoel Unger told me a Varda a few years ago. I believe he said that when you'll tell me if I'm saying it wrong. But I hope I say it right, otherwise I'm in trouble. So he said that when Yaakov came to Lavan and he said, I want to marry your daughter, Lavan says, it's better for me to give her to you than to give it to another man. As if like, you know, this is a classic father-in-law, son-in-law. Okay, you'll do, you're good enough. But why did Lavan say that? He said, because Lavan knew that Rachel and Leah were both tzaddikim. Lavan is not interested in having more tzaddikim in the world. Now, Lavan knows, Chazal tell us, that the wife tends to influence the husband spiritually far more than the husband tends to influence the wife spiritually. And Chazal tell us, Eishes Koirach, classic example of a wife destroying the husband. The wife of Imbim Pelas, the classic example of a wife helping the husband. And so Lavan says, look, if Rachel and Leah marry some guy off the street, they'll make them into tzaddikim. Better they should marry you. You're already a tzaddik. Less tzaddikim that I have to worry about. Did I say it over right? Okay, thank you. So Lavan is not interested in a Yaakov. Yaakov's a tzaddik. Lavan's a Rasha. He doesn't want Yaakov here. So Yaakov has to look at the situation and say, look, why does Lavan want me here? It must be there's something that's pulling, attracting him. What? He's a Rasha. I'm a tzaddik. There must be Kedusha left in Lavan. And if there's Kedusha left in Lavan, that's what's attracting him. There's something there trying to get out that's attracted to me, the tzaddik, says Yaakov, and that means I have more work to do. And so as long as Lavan is smiling at him and saying, please stay, I want you here, Yaakov knows there's still some Kedusha that's attracting Lavan to him. The second Yaakov looks at Lavan and says, his face is not to him. The exact language of the pasuk. His face is not like it was yesterday and the day before. Yaakov says, that's it. There's nothing left. I pulled everything out that I'm going to pull out. It's time for me to go back. Okay? And so that is the Yaakov love and relationship, but that's the story. And that really is the story of every Golos Klal Yisrael will go into. The Gemara tells us that Klal Yisrael only go into Golos to attract to them converts. That's okay. Now, the Gemara says a lot of other things about why Klal Yisrael go into Golos. That's a very strange statement to make. I mean, ostensibly we go into Golos because we didn't live up to what we were supposed to live up to. We didn't accomplish, and so we have to go into exile. But the Gemara says Klal Yisrael go into Golos to attract here. What does that mean? What it means is this very idea. There's Kedusha out there, and we need to go out into Golos to attract it to us. To pull it to us. It's there. We have to get it. Now the question becomes, well, if Klal Yisrael wouldn't have sinned, how would that have happened? So, now Rizal says that had Klal Yisrael lived up to their lofty spiritual level that they should have, then they could have lived in Eretz Yisrael, they would have acted as a magnet to pull all the Kedusha towards them without having to leave. But if the magnet's too weak, if the Kedusha that you're giving off is not strong enough, then you have to go out and make it happen instead. Okay? And this idea you'll see throughout history. Klal Yisrael wander from place to place, and they're there for a while, and then they get sick of them, and they throw them out. This is the history of our exile. Right? Why? The answer is that Hashem needs us to go from place to place because there are these nitzaitzes, there's this kedusha that we have to attract towards us in every place. So Klal Yisrael are in Spain. I'll just throw out a number, 500 years. Let's just say, you know, from at least the successful era of Jews in Spain, for 500 years, let's say. 1492, they're thrown out. There's not one Jew, there are Jews left, Muranos and so on, but all the Jews get thrown out. We don't really hear of Spain again, except on Pesach vacations for some reason. But outside of that, we don't hear about Spain again. Okay? Jews are in Germany for thousands of years, and then Germany becomes Judenrein during the Holocaust. Now there are Jews there again, but Europe as a whole, right? The center of the population shift from place to place. Jews are in Israel, they're in Babel, then they move to Europe, they move to the United States. Why? So the answer is because each place there's a purpose to be there. And by the way, this is really a very important idea. If you ever end up in a weird place somewhere, you missed your connecting flight or something like that, whatever it may be, okay, it's frustrating, whatever, but there's a reason you're there. Take out a Tehillim. learn something, daven something. There's a reason you're there. Bring some kedusha to the place. You want to know why you missed your connecting flight in Dusseldorf, Germany? I don't know if there's an airport there or not, but there is. Okay, why am I in? Because Hashem wants you to say a few program of the hill in there. You know, you don't know why you're there, but you know, do instead of just lamenting the fact that you missed your connecting flight, make the most of it. You never know why you end up in a place, but there's always kedusha to be pulled out. Okay, the overarching the paradigm of Golos, of exile, is Mitzrayim, is Egypt, and. One of the many aspects of going into Mitzrayim, into Egypt, was because there's a great deal of potential latent in Egypt at that time. Egypt is the center of civilization, the most powerful civilization on earth at the time. There's a great deal of potential latent in Egypt that needs to be pulled out. Egypt is, at the same time being the most powerful country in the world, is also the most depraved, decadent society on the face of the earth as well. Famously, Yosef's 17-year-old teenager gets sent down to Egypt, which is called Ervas Aretz. Yosef refers to it as Ervas Aretz. Okay, when the brothers come into Egypt, he tells them, you came to spy out Ervas Aretz. The word Ervo, in the context, means you want to spy out the land for the hidden places, to expose the hidden places. Okay, but the term Ervo is generally in the Torah associated with immorality, immoral relationships. Okay, that's the idea of Erva. And Egypt is the center of that in the world. The center, but there's tremendous Kedusha over there that needs to be developed and needs to be pulled out. So just like we find that Yaakov had to go to love and to pull all that Kedusha out, how does he pull that Kedusha out? He walks out with his two daughters, 12 tribes, and a lot of his money. So the money he gets, that Yaakov gets, the money is not just there because he needs to be wealthy. It's not to put his name up on a yeshiva building. The money he gets is to use in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's to bring it to Kedusha. It's to use it for sanctified purposes. And so we find Yaakov, famously, in the middle of the night, crossing over the Yabok River to get a few pachim ketanim, a few small earthenware jugs. Why is that so important? Put himself in danger, ends up having to fight with the Malach of Esav the whole night. It's dangerous. Why? The Gemara says, because for tzaddikim, their money is more important to them than their bodies. What does that mean? What it means is that they recognize that whatever Hashem gives them, every last penny, there's something they have to do with it. They have to be careful with it. They have to be responsible for it. Don't fritter it away. Don't use it in an improper fashion. Use it properly. It has to be developed. So in Klal Yisrael, on a very basic level, when they leave Egypt, when they leave Mitzrayim, they're taking not just themselves out of Mitzrayim as the Jewish nation being born out of Egypt, more about that soon, but they're also going to pull all the Kedusha out of Mitzrayim. If they don't pull the Kedusha out of Mitzrayim, so then a big part of their purpose of their Gullus will have been for naught. They have to go in there not just be born as a nation, but they also need to pull all the Kedusha out of Mitzrayim in the form of their money, their gold, their silver, their clothing, etc., etc. That's a major part, that's an important part of what has to happen. That's a very important part of what has to happen. And if you look throughout, thank you. If you look throughout the Torah, and even in Tanakh as well, even in Nach, you will find that whenever there's a war of any sort, there's a very, very often a focus put on the spoils of war. Okay, when the Bnei Yisrael fight against Midian, there's a whole section of the Torah that talks about what they did with the spoils of the war. When they fight against Yericho, famously, Hashem said, "Don't touch the spoils." Achan fails, and he touches it. Okay, in Megillas Esther, we just read it a week and a half ago. It talks about not just that the Bnei Yisrael rose up against their enemies and killed their enemies, but the Megillah talks about they didn't touch the spoils. There's such a focus on spoils of war. Why? Same idea. Because when you go to war with a nation, you're not just defeating them militarily. Okay, true victory of one nation over another is that you incorporate that nation into your own, into yourself. Okay, whenever you have military campaigns of conquest, which are very unpopular today, if your name is Israel, but otherwise it's okay. But when you have military campaigns of conquest, where one nation takes over another, they don't just defeat them, they will rule over them. They will incorporate they will try to incorporate that nation into themselves as much as possible. Okay, because true victory is not just defeating them, it's incorporating the other nation into your own nation. And by B'nai Yisrael, it's the same thing. When B'nai Yisrael wage war against another nation, it's not enough just to defeat them, they incorporate from our vantage point, whatever Kedusha is there, whatever potential is latent, that nation is incorporated by B'nai Yisrael into Klal Yisrael to use to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so there's always a focus on the biza, on the spoils, and so on, and you have to check. Why by Yericha did Hashem say not to touch it? Good question. Why by the Megillah did they not touch it? Also something you have to look into. But there's a focus on the spoils, as it's not just that we defeated them, we are swallowing them, as it were. In the sense, you're incorporating them. And Rav Moshe Shapiro points out, he should be gesund, that you will find a lot of terms of eating associated with war. The word milchama is very similar to the word lechem. Weapons are called clay, zayin, as in the word zun. Hazdanes ha'olam kulay b'tavay. Okay, you will find affiliations of eating associated with. You find also that when Hashem talks about, when the Torah talks about waging war, it talks about it very often in terms of eating the other nation, consuming the other nation, and so on and so forth. Because there's an idea of incorporating something, what's important to you, of the other nation into yourself. And the Klal Yisrael is taking all that Kedusha, and that's why they sort of focus on the spoils. And so when Yisrael left Mitzrayim, Hashem made Avraham Avinu, and I'm going to try to develop this idea in a moment, but Hashem promised Avraham Avinu not just that B'nai Yisrael will go through Mitzrayim and will emerge on the other side of the nation, but they will also take out of Mitzrayim a rechush gadol, a great wealth. Avraham Avinu doesn't care about the money. The rechush gadol is the spiritual richness inherent in the possessions of the Egyptians that B'nai Yisrael will take out and will develop properly. Yosef spent years amassing all the wealth into Mitzrayim. Why? Because, so that, Rev Dessler points out, he spent years amassing all the money, so that later B'nai Yisrael could take that money out of Mitzrayim and be Mekadosh Shem Shemayim with it. Make a Kiddush Hashem. Yosef's whole life was devoted to Kiddush Hashem. He comes to Paray and he says, it's not me, it's Hashem. Everything is about Hashem. So why is Yosef focused on amassing all this money? Because Yosef knows that money will later be used by B'nai Yisrael centuries later to be the Kaddish Shem Shemayim. That's the bottom line of the money. The question becomes now, okay, so why then is Hashem having such a hard time fulfilling this promise? We understand why Hashem made the promise. We understand why there's a focus on the money. So Hashem should just say, okay, guys, you're leaving Egypt. Make sure that you don't just take yourselves out. Take all the Kedusha out with you. Instead, Hashem says, please speak to them. Tell them, I have a promise to keep. I really have to keep this promise. I promised Avram. Avram's not going to understand. He's going to miss it. I don't want to have to get into a whole argument with him. I don't want him to complain. Please make sure that you take it out. So the Gemara continues. I left off a piece of the Gemara. I want to continue the Gemara that I mentioned earlier. And the Gemara continues and says as follows. It says, it compares the whole situation of B'nai Yisrael in Egypt, going out of Egypt, to a prisoner. And the Gemara says that it's like a person who's in prison, and you come to the fellow and you say, tomorrow they're taking you out of prison, and they're going to give you a lot of money. And the prisoner says, do me a favor, I don't need the money, just get me out. Okay? That is the analogy. That is the muscle. That is the muscle given of B'nai Yisrael's situation in Egypt. So, this Gemara always bothered me before I decided to actually develop and figure out what's going on. If a person's in jail, he wants to get out of jail, I understand. But if you give him a $1 million check as he's running out, he'll take the check, won't he? Won't he take the check? I think so. You know, tomorrow you're getting out of jail and you're getting money. I don't need the money, just getting out of jail. I mean, yes, if I have to choose between $1 million and getting out, I'll get out. But if you're offering me both, I mean, why not? I'll make a snob remark once I'm at it. It's kind of like, you know, today out of the... All right. today when the some, I won't say a lot, but there are some bachurim out there who are looking for a shidduch, and they want to learn also. So they say, I need to get married. I want a nice girl with all the miles, and she has to have a lot of money. Okay, so I am not getting involved in that discussion. I'm just making this snide remark. And so if I get both, that's great. You know, I'm looking for a nice girl with a little mileage, but if she has money also, I mean, that's Kabbalistic. So, you know, if you get out of prison with the money, why not? Why the stress on B'nai Yisrael, to be pushed? Please take the money. Why? So, the Sfasemis talks about this, others talk about this as well, the Shem Shmuel, a lot of Mepharshim talk about this idea, and let's talk about B'nai Yisrael going out of Mitzrayim when they left. We all know that Hashem told Avram they will be in Egypt for how long? 400 years. In reality, they were actually in Egypt for how long? 210. How long was the slavery? Huh? Don't look at you. Okay, too many years since seminary. How many years were they actually enslaved? Anybody? Close. 86. 86 from the time of the birth of Miriam, hence the name Miriam, comes from the word mar, bitter. As a more, Miriam, someone asked me a while, someone told me a while ago, not terribly religious, but somewhat knowledgeable individual, said, I have heard that if you have the name Miriam, you're supposed to add another nicer name with it. Because the name Miriam in of itself connotes mar, bitterness. I don't know if anyone here has a name, please put no stock in my comments. I have not heard this. Miriam is that's when the Shibud started. She was ultimately the one who also prophesied about the imminent birth of Moshe, the Goyal. Also, she when she was 3 years old, she was 6 years old, she said that her mother was going to have a child who would redeem Klal Yisrael. So, and she was actually the impetus. Amram had initially sent Yocheved away because of the decree to throw all the babies, to kill all the babies, and all the baby boys, and she told her father, the Gemara says that she told her father, Paris, because there is only against the male children, you are making a decree against both the male and female children. Amram listened to her, took her back, so Miriam ultimately was both the source of the prophecy and the source of the marriage that brought about Moshe Rabbeinu. But 86 years. They were in Mitzrayim for 210 years, and the Mepharshim point out, well, Rashi tells us already, that the 400 years were fulfilled from the time that Yitzchok was born. Yitzchok was born on Pesach, and so at that point there was a fulfillment of Ki Ger Yiyeh Zarecha Be'eretz Le'ilohem, that your children will be Ger, they will be people who are sojourning, who are not settled. Okay, and so that was fulfilled with Yitzchok, 400 years to the day, to the moment of Yitzchok's birth, B'nai Yisrael left Egypt. Okay, that notwithstanding that we have an idea. Some of you probably have this custom. I have the custom that by the Seder we eat an egg. Some of you have that custom. All right, you don't. What? Is why you have it on the Ka'ara, and perhaps maybe why you eat it as well. But there's another reason why we eat an egg, because an egg is a sign of mourning. Okay, and it's pointed out that the first night of Pesach is always the same night of the week as Tisha B'Av. By the way, if everyone want to know when Yom Tovim are coming out for the coming year, there's the Atbash piece, if you're familiar with it. Everything parallels Pesach. Atbash is the first and last night of the Aleph piece. So Aleph, first night of Pesach, is Tov Tisha B'Av. Bey, the second night of Pesach, is Shin Shavuos. Gimel, the third night of Pesach, is Reish Rosh Hashanah. Past that, I tend to get a little bit lost. Someone once pointed out, this is not an endorsement, but someone once pointed out that I think the Ayin parallels the day of Yom Ha'atzma'ut. And so it works out that way. I'm not endorsing that, but yes, figure it out. It works out the same day of the week. I'm not giving an endorsement to that. I'm just saying. So,
when do you eat the egg?
Do you think so? I don't know other people's costume. My family, we eat it at the beginning of Shulchan Aruch.
Yeah, the very beginning.
After Maror, before you have the Suda. Okay.
Dipped in salt water.
Dipped in salt water. Yeah. Right. Dipped in salt water, again, because that's the saltiness, the bitterness, and so on. It's very exciting, and it's very convenient to figure out when the Yom Tovim fall out parallel to Pesach. But the fact that the night of Tisha B'Av happens to parallel the night of Pesach is very exciting, but it's Pesach. It's Zman Cheruseinu. It's Zman Geulaseinu. Why are we dealing with Tisha B'Av and Pesach? Okay? So the answer is, a lot of us talk about this, that really, as many of you are aware, B'nai Yisrael were a moment away from being lost forever in the spiritual morass of Egypt. And we know that if Hashem had to leave the Chippazon in haste, had they stayed for a moment longer, they would have been spiritually assimilated, completely lost in the impurity of Egypt. They had to leave that moment. Really, they were supposed to stay longer. Really, the 400 years were supposed to be for the period of their stay in Egypt. But because they couldn't last any longer, because their spiritual descent was much greater than Hashem had wanted, they had to be pulled out early. And so we say, Baruch Hashem Rav Tuchasai, Shakalish Baruch Hu Chishev Es HaKetz. We say in the God, Hashem calculated the Ketz, the end. And everyone knows, the Vilna Gaon says, Ketz is Gematria, the numerical value of 190. Hashem calculated 190 years missing from the 400 years. Bnei Yisrael left after 210. He calculated that 190 years from the 400 years. What does that mean? What that means is as follows. Whenever anything happens in the world, whenever a decree is supposed to happen, there are multiple ways it can happen. If you have a nevuah, there are multiple ways it can play itself out. Prophecies tend to be very vague, and they're vague for a reason, because it can play itself out in multiple ways, which is why we really don't know what's going to happen when Mashiach comes. Because yes, there are prophecies, and every time something calamitous happens, everyone finds a zoyar somewhere that, oh, the Twin Towers fell, there's this thing about two eagles crashing into two... I don't know if anyone heard this by 9/11. We don't know what's going to happen. The Rambam says this. We don't really know what's going to happen. What do you mean? There are prophecies. Yes, they're just that. It could play out in innumerable ways. We don't know exactly. After it plays out, you could say, oh, that's how it played out. So when Bnei Yisrael go out of Mitzrayim, and you say, 400 years, yeah, Kigeri Yazaracha. Yitzchak lived in, he moved around, he wasn't settled. Eretz Yisrael, it played out that way. It could have, and ideally should have, played out as 400 years from when Yaakov arrived in Mitzrayim. For 400 years. That's how it ideally should have played out. And had they managed to last for those 400 years, the cleansing process, which I'll try to expand on momentarily, of Egypt, that Bnei Israel had to go through, would have been so thorough, there would have been no need to ever go through any other gullus ever again after that. They would have been perfected, complete, they would have left Egypt perfect, whole, ready to go on Eretz Yisrael, stay there forever, no exile, no sin, everything's great. They didn't make it. They assimilated too quickly, too rapidly, their spiritual descent was too great, they had to go out sooner, Hashem had to switch to plan B to keep his promise to Avram, get them out after 210, but there was much work left to be done, and ultimately they had to go through four more exiles. And I just saw this morning, a little while ago, the Shasemis points out, and again, I don't have time, nor do I necessarily know all the answers, but the Pasuk in Parshas Bo'i says that there was actually a period of 430 years. Pasuk in Parshas Bo'i says, Bnei Yisrael were in Egypt for 430 years. And Rashi says 430 years was from the time of the Bris Ben Absarim. Okay? Because once the Nevuah was put into play, that already began the exile. Okay? There was a plan of 430 full years in Egypt. There was that possibility, somehow. Okay, again, exactly how it played out, 400, 430, I don't know, 430 years. They left after how many years of slavery, of servitude? 86. 86 is one-fifth of 430. And so, we have the Golos of Mitzrayim, and if you add another 86 year period, you end up at 430. And so Bnei Yisrael never took care of the other four exiles that they would go through later. Why it's not 86 years also, separate discussion, but somehow it fulfills that period of time or the suffering and servitude. There's another four sets of 86 years that they should have gone through in Egypt, but they couldn't because they weren't going to last. So they left early. Now they have to leave early. Now let's take a step back. They have to leave early, and this is, by the way, true for everything. It's brought down in Sfarim that when Hashem created the world, the spiritual power of Tisha B'Av was already in play. In fact, it's brought down that when the initial very first, if you will, separation of anything beyond HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself took place on Tisha B'Av. In other words, the idea of separation from Hashem, that there's something else besides HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was created on Tisha B'Av, and that later became exile, bigger separation from Hashem, and so on. Does that mean Tisha B'Av was inevitable? The answer is no. Yes and no. Which is the answer to every question in Judaism. Yes and no. Yes, it's inevitable, but how it would play itself out was not inevitable. That Tisha B'Av means destruction of Beis HaMikdash, exile, that's not inevitable. How it plays itself out, how that separation manifests itself depends on us. And the exile in Egypt, how it plays itself out depends on Klal Yisrael, how they manage in Egypt. So here's the deal. When Hashem tells Avram they're going to be slaves in Egypt for 400 years, then they will go out with great wealth. What Hashem meant was, they'll be in Egypt, They'll be, he didn't say Egypt. They'll be strangers in the land that's not theirs, 400 years. That means they'll be in that land for 400 years, and the work and the cleansing process that they will undergo over there will allow them, after 400 years, to be completely perfected, and then they will go out with all the sanctity that's in Egypt, because they've reached the pinnacle in Egypt itself. They've done all the work that has to be done. I'll try to explain exactly how that all works in a minute. But they've done all the work that has to be done. Now they go out, they take all the Kedusha with them from Egypt. Egypt is where all the Kedusha in the world is centered. It's the center of world civilization. Everything's there. They will overpower that. Hashem will wage war against the Egyptians. You'll notice of Yashar, there's a lot of terminology of Hashem being in Ishmael Chama, right? Rashi tells us that Klal Yisrael had a perception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as being a warrior at the Yom Sof. This is a war. And they're fighting against Egypt. And a war means milchama, lechem. They're going to consume them. Had B'nai Israel stayed in Mitzrayim for the full period and gone through the process of gullus, they could have pulled everything out properly, perfectly. Everything would have been done. It didn't happen. So really, they're leaving Egypt prematurely. Hashem does them a favor and pulls them out now. And that's why Pesach is the Yom Tov of Chesed, of kindness. Each of the Yom Tovim parallels one of the Chesed, Din is Yitzchak, and Yaakov is Teiret, Feres, whatever you want to call it. Each of the three Regalim, Pesach is Chesed. Pesach is always the Yom Tov of Chesed. Kindness, because really B'nai Israel didn't deserve it. Hashem did them a favor and pulled them out. They had to do something to get themselves out, so they had to bring a Dam Milah, Dam Pesach, right? We say in the Haggadah, I saw you wallowing in your blood. Rashi is the blood of the two mitzvahs. Not our discussion right now, but just the reason the blood is important is because blood is always a connection between us and Hashem. Blood is the life. And so through the blood, we connected, instead of being connected to Egypt, we brought that blood through HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we connected a blood link between us and Hashem.
But
and do something, huh?
But for money.
That the Torah calls money down. Exactly. But that's the other idea, because you spend your life earning money, you use your life, your blood for the money, to use it for the right reasons. But you are correct, yeah. Yeah, it's very clear in the Torah that when you steal money from a person, in a sense, there's an element of taking the life of the person, to some degree.
But it's called damim.
Damim, yes. Because you spend your life on it, right? People spend their life. And, yeah, absolutely. When the Torah says, b'chol me'oidecho, you love Hashem with all your ma'oid, so Rashi says your money. There are some people who like their money more than their lives. You know the famous joke, money in your life?
Okay.
Take my money, I take my life, I need the money for my old age. But there are people, I mean, it's a known fact. People lose their money and they kill themselves. Right? It's a phenomenon. Why? The answer is, their entire essence and existence is tied up with their money. For other people, it's not their money, it's something else. Right? You have a politician who spent his whole life building his career, and then he gets involved in a scandal, beyond me why he got involved in it in the first place, but Yitzhahara does its work. And he loses everything, and then he shoots himself in the head a week later, because his entire essence, existence, is his career. He lost his career, it's finished. So ma'oid doesn't mean money, it means ma'oid means very. That which is everything to you, give that to Hashem. To some
degree,
yeah. I mean, that would be the ma'od, yeah. That was the nisayon of Avram with Yitzchak, Mefarshim say. Yitzchak was everything. His whole life was build a Klal Yisrael. Hashem says, out the window. So it's greater than giving up his life. It's his entire existence is in Yitzchak. And Hashem says, put him up on the Mizbeach. That was the nisayon. That's the ma'od. Yeah. So if a Talmud Chacham gets to a situation where he can't learn, and, you know, That could be. I just saw, I'm going off on way too many tangents here, but I just saw, I got the newsletter for the Mir Yerushalayim dinner or some campaign. So they had a little article there about Rifol Shmulevitz. That's all, who passed away a few months ago. So it says he once told, I think one of his sons, he said, do you think I don't want COVID? Of course I want COVID. But COVID for me is not what it is for everyone else. COVID, stand up for me, that's meaningless. He says, for me, COVID is say over a good vart in my name. You know, a good part of that's covered. So, and the point they were making was that was his life. Different people have different focuses in their life. But absolutely, a person whose entire life is learning, if he has to lose that, then that is, that could destroy them. You know, possibly. Okay, so they really left early. If they left early, that means they really didn't have the claim to pull out the Rechush Gadol, the money, and by extension, or really inherently, the Kedusha that they needed to pull out of Egypt. They didn't finish the job. It wasn't done yet. So Hashem has to pull them out with the potential for failure, but the money really should stay behind. And so the Sfasama says that Hashem did two kindnesses for Klal Yisrael when he pulled them out of Egypt. One is that he pulled them out in the nick of time, and the second thing is he allowed them to take the Kedusha out as well, even though they hadn't really refined it fully. They hadn't really properly and fully refined it and pulled it out from the tomb of Mitzrayim yet. They hadn't yet done that. But Hashem did them a favor and let them take it out anyways. And that, says the Mefarshim, is the exchange between Hashem and Moshe. Hashem tells Moshe, please tell Bnei Yisrael to take the money. And the Gemara says, it's like a person, he told a person to leave prison, and I'm also giving you money, he says, just get me out of prison. The point is this. The point is, the person leaving prison knows that that money is not his. He has no claim to that money. So, when you have a person who leaves prison, okay, who messed up in life, let's just say, made mistakes, and you give him a lot of money, it's very dangerous. A person who is not refined, give him a lot of money, is a very dangerous engagement because it can be abused, it can be used improperly. Money has to go to the right people. If it's in the wrong hands, it's a disaster, as we see every day. Okay, money in the wrong hands is an absolute disaster. So when the person leaves prison, he just get me out of here. Let me, you know, if you want to get me out, and let me finish my development. But don't give me the money. I'm not ready for it yet. I'm not ready for it yet. And Hashem says, take it anyways. Please take it and use it properly. What do they ultimately use the money for? Before the Beit HaMikdash. There you go. And Moshe tells Hashem, he says, you know what you do in the Klal Yisrael? It's like you take a 15-year-old kid, you give him a lot of food to eat, and you give him a lot of drink, and he's satiated, he's a little bit tipsy, and you give him a packet of money around his neck, and you put him outside a place of not such great repute, okay, you know, somewhere downtown, and you say, okay, see you later. What's he going to do? What do you think he's going to do? He's getting into trouble. And so Moshe tells Hashem, what do you want from Klal Yisrael? You put them into this mess. Egel Azov came because, what's Egel Azov? Egel Azov is the very first step towards Golos. It's the biggest disaster towards Golos. And what happened? Hashem gave them all this gold and they went and made an Egel with it. Because they took the money, really they didn't want the money. Because they knew it's dangerous. They could develop themselves further and use it properly. Or because there's still something missing there. There's something that wasn't cleaned out yet. They didn't completely refine themselves. It could be disastrous. Ultimately, they use it for the Mishkan. Like you said, you're correct. That's why it's a kapara. The Mishkan is the kapara for the Cheta Egel. Because the Mishkan is the rectification. It's using the money properly. But initially, it's a disaster. Initially, they use it improperly. Yeah. Why did he think is a much bigger discussion not for right now. I mean, suffice to say that Aaron knew, it seems clear that Aaron knew this was wrong. He made himself the sacrificial lamb on behalf of the Bnei Yisrael. In other words, he took the fall for them. Okay, he tried to delay them, but ultimately he took the fall for them. Okay, you find this kind of paradox. I don't want to get into this now, but you find this kind of paradox in Aaron that on the one hand he's taken to task for the eagle, and at the same time he's the Kohen Gadol because of the eagle. Will the real Aaron please step up? Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, you find this all over the place. You'll find this throughout the Torah. You'll find people doing things, and on the one hand they're praised, and at the same moment they are. Avraham Avinu is praised for sending Lloyd away. Hashem doesn't talk to him as long as Lloyd is with him, and yet the Medrash takes him to task for sending Lloyd away. Yaakov Avinu, on the one hand, is praised for trying to bring Esav back, and yet at the same time he said, why, the famous phrase in the Al Toichaz Ba'aznei HaKelev, don't pull the ears of the dog. Or in English, it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. So you find all over the place this dichotomy, you know, of good, bad, together. Which one is it? So, you know, that has to be fleshed out in every scenario. Okay? So here's a very, very fascinating idea that the Sfasemis talks about, and I'm adding my 2 cents or perhaps more for whatever it's worth to it. The Sfasemis, when he talks about this idea, he says that is the idea of the Erev Rav. That's the Erev Rav. Erev Rav, now I'll explain what I perhaps think maybe he means, if not, it's me talking. But the Erev Rav, when they left Egypt, came up with Bnei Yisrael. Hashem didn't want them to go. And Moshe told Hashem, they want to come close to you, I shouldn't take them. Hashem said, do what you want, but I'm telling you this is a bad idea. Okay? And later on by the Chet HaEgel, who were the instigators of the Chet HaEgel? The Erev Rav. Very few members of Klal Yisrael actually took the Egel, the calf, as idolatrous. By and large, they, not our discussion right now, they wanted to use it as a replacement for Moshe. Okay? But who said, Ela Elohecha Yisrael, Asher Eluchem Eretz Mitzrayim, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And the Medrash says, it doesn't say Ela Eloheinu, this is our God, this is your God. So it's an outside party talking to the Jewish people, says the Medrash, the Erev Rav saying, this is your God. And Hashem tells Moshe, raise my hand, he said, go down now, ki shiches amcha, your nation has corrupted itself. And Moshe tells Hashem, my nation, not your nation. And Hashem says, it's the Erev Rav. And they're your problem, not mine, because I told you to leave him, and you said, I want to take him out. Okay? Says this Hashem, the Erev Rav, exactly the word Erev is a mixture, is because we mentioned at the outset, all the Merishim, when he sinned, what did he do? He mixed everything. And so when Israel left Egypt, part of that was to take these converts with them. To take these converts with them. That was part of the wealth, if you will, of Egypt, was taking the Kedusha there. That's the Sfasamis. I would like to add that the reason why it was such a dismal failure, and the reason why Hashem told Moshe not to do it, was because it wasn't a finished job. So these Erev Rav, yes, they have potential, and yes, there's something there which needs to be taken, but it's not a good idea because you didn't finish the job. So there's great danger there. And ultimately, the Erev Rav are the ones, that part that wasn't cleaned out, is going to pose challenges for Klal Yisrael, and the very money that was never finished is going to be the tool they're going to use for the source of Klal Yisrael's downfall. So here's another very, very fascinating idea. Makas Choshech, the plague of darkness. It's brought down in Tzorim, you've probably heard this at some point, but the pasuk tells us that for the Egyptians it was dark, and there was light in their dwellings. Okay? Rashi tells us, Chazal tells us, that Bnei Yisrael, what were they doing during the plague of darkness? They were going from house to house, checking out all the treasures of Egypt. And they were looking around, seeing where stuff was. So when they came to the Egyptians, they said, can I borrow your gold, Becher Hathmei Kiddush? Some point when I go, the Egyptian, sorry, I'm fresh out of gold beffers. No, it's in this closet. So that's the simple understanding is that they went from house to house and they checked where everything was. And so the plague of darkness was an opportunity for Bnei Israel to see where everything was. That's a simple understanding. Fair enough. But it is brought down in many places that the light that the Bnei Israel had during the plague of darkness was not a regular light. It wasn't just like the regular daylight. It was a special light, what we call the Or HaGanuz, that light that Hashem hid away, the spiritual light of creation, that's what shined for Bnei Yisrael. It's brought further in the Sfarim, that the very same, that was the very same, it's brought down a Medrash, that it says, according to one opinion, the darkness of the Egyptians was a darkness of Shemayim, of heaven itself. And I believe Rabbi Levi Yitzchok Bar Ditchever, the Medrash seems to say that, he says, based on this Medrash, the very same thing, darkness, that came down from Shemayim for the Egyptians was the very same light for the Bnei Yisrael. The Pasuk puts it together. All the Egyptians had darkness. It wasn't a separate light. That darkness was light for the Bnei Yisrael. Why? It's like when you wake up in the morning and you open your eyes and you try to look out the window, it's a sunny day, what happens? You can't see anything. You can't see anything. It's just dark. Because it's too much. For the Egyptians, Hashem gave you a special light. And for the Egyptians, they couldn't handle it. So all they had was darkness. Bnei Israel used that light. Now, why do they need that light to spy out the Egyptians? So I would like to say, and I ran this by someone this morning, and he said, that would seem to be Pashup Shak. Bnei Israel aren't just looking for money. What are they looking for? They're looking for the Kedusha that the Mitzrayim have in their houses. Well, how do you find Kedusha in sunlight? The answer is, when the special spiritual light, the Or HaGanuz, the light of creation, shines down, that light lets you see what's really happening. So when Bnei Yisrael went from house to house looking for the money of the Mitzrayim, they were looking for the Kedusha. How are they going to look for that Kedusha? That special light, that spiritual light, let them see what was going on. And that's what they had to take out of Mitzrayim. Okay, and I would just add one more thing, and that is that by this, we call it on the night of the Seder, it's called Leil HaSeder. Seder. Why is it called a Seder? A lot of different approaches. Why it's called a Seder? In order. Call it. You could find something more exciting than to call it in order. Okay, why is it called a Seder? I think perhaps the answer is, and the Tfasemis makes this point also, doesn't say it about the word Seder, but he says, on Pesach, on every Yom Tov, we're not just commemorating the anniversary, the very same spiritual power that came down on that Yom Tov, when it happened, comes down every year, nothing more so, no other Yom Tov more true than Pesach, when we have to relive. Chayim Adam Lira says, Atmai, you have to see yourself as if you yourself left Egypt. So every year we have the opportunity of leaving Mitzrayim, of taking, separating the light from the dark, the good from the bad. That's the work of Pesach every year. And yes, Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim early to the extent where really they shouldn't have taken that stuff out. And Hashem did a chesed. And Hashem said, I promise Avram, and there's a lot of discussion, I didn't have time to get into it, why Hashem couldn't just tell Avram, well, I'm sorry, but they didn't last the full 400 years, so I can't give it to them. Okay, I don't have time now to go into a discussion, but Avram, it's just very, very briefly, the Shem Yishmol says that part of the reason why they were able to get out early was because of the schus of Avram himself. Uh-huh. The merit of Avram, Hashem promised Avram that we'll get out. In Avram's eyes, he's such an onov, his schus will not be sufficient. And so Hashem's going to tell Avram, well, really, they got out early because of you. Avram's going to say, me? They got out early because of me? It's not because of me. It can't be because of me. They must have still done their full time. So where's the rechush? Where's all the wealth? And Hashem said, no, really, they didn't finish. I pulled them out early because I promised you, it's in your merit. But Avram, the honor that he is, won't be able to relate to that. Okay? That's one approach, at least, to explain why Avram would not be able to understand Hashem's answer, so Hashem has to make Avram happy. Another approach, which Rabbi Shapiro says, is when you enter an agreement, a bris is on the terms of understanding of both sides. So if Avram walks into the bris understanding that no matter what, Bnei Yisrael will walk out with the Kedusha, and that's his bottom line that has to happen, even if Hashem had other plans, but if Avram had this understanding, and Hashem had that understanding, it has to be unequal, you know, based on a bris means we're doing it according to the understanding of both parties, which is a simpler approach than the first one. But they're both valid approaches. But the idea of a Seder, then, is putting everything in order. The whole idea of a Seder is every Pesach we're taking is the beginning of a process of putting the separating the good from the bad. Taking the light that Hashem gives us, Hashem does a chesed and gives us this tremendous light, Leil Shimurim. And the revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the opportunity for us to begin the process of separating the good from the bad. And so it's called a Seder because instead of just a mixture, you are separating good and evil from each other. And so the whole avoid of the Seder is to bring us to a point where we experience the going out of Egypt of pulling the last little kernel of purity that was Klal Yisrael, that was left, that Hashem snatched out of Egypt at the last second. That little kernel of Toiv, and with that little kernel, all the other Toiv gets drawn with it out of Mitzrayim. Not because they really deserved it, but that's how Hashem set it up as a kindness. And so the work of Mitzrayim is to take that kernel of goodness and pull it out. That's the work of the Seder. And to put everything in order. Leave the bad behind, a.k.a. Chametz. Everyone knows Chametz is the Eitz Hara. And Pesach has 8 days of just pure Toiv. And we leave the chametz behind. We don't engage it. We don't fight with it. We don't deal with it. We leave it behind. It's a period of time where we can pull the good out. And Hashem gives us the opportunity to pull the good out from the evil and to put things in order. Okay. And so it thus emerges that the rechush gadol, the great wealth that Hashem promised Klal Yisrael and that Klal Yisrael ultimately took out, although they weren't deserving, is nonetheless there for us to take if we utilize it properly on Pesach. And so Pesach is specifically to say there is a time for us to try to move ourselves in a direction of putting things in order. Is this good? Is this bad? Is this good? Is this bad? That's a time for us to pull ourselves out from the mix, perhaps the mess of the last 2 weeks preparing for Pesach. And you walk into Pesach, right? Hopefully you're awake somewhat. I know that my mother, as much as everyone else hates it, my mother appreciates a Matzah Shabbos Pesach. where you, because then I have a whole Shabbos to sleep beforehand. So the men don't like it so much because of the hassle of Bir Chametz and the Friday Purim. But I think the women have a much greater appreciation of when Pesach comes out of Matzah Shabbos because you have a Shabbos to recuperate before the Seder. But my mother always says she always enjoys the second Seder much more than the first Seder. The night later, I say everyone nodding their heads. Okay. But that is the idea of the Rechush Gadol, and that's really the idea of Golos in general. It's that we need to come into a society that is very much against our values, but to try to use it in a way and to relate to it and use it in a way that we can pull whatever we can out of it without being pulled into it. That's the challenge we have in general in our lives, and certainly that is the work of a Pesach as well. Yeah, thank you all for coming. Go ahead, if you have any questions.
Just out of curiosity, with what you just said last.
Yeah.
The fact that things are looking really, really bad here, does that mean we've pulled a lot of it out?
Perhaps, potentially. But you have both sides. In other words, you have on the one hand the ability to pull it out, but at the same time, the problem that Bnei Israel encountered in Egypt was that they became very connected as well.
All right.
So that's the challenge, is you need to pull out without getting drawn in. The failure of Klal Yisrael was that they got pulled in too much, and so they had to leave early. So as much as possible, we need to pull ourselves away. Ultimately, Hashem had to pull them out instead, because they couldn't do it on their own. All right. So this is it. That's why the Gemara says that either Klal Yisrael do, according to one opinion, I don't want to scare everyone, but it says that either Klal Yisrael do tshuva on their own, or it says that Hashem says I'm going to make a melech koshek haman, a king as difficult as Haman upon them, and that will force them to do tshuva as we found in the days of Purim. Yeah. If anyone makes any allusions to American politics, I'm going to hit them on the head. So it's that's right.